This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Aaron Newcomb and I talk with Ahmed Sobha about Linux and open source and all kinds of stuff in the developing world. It is so interesting. There's so much stuff going on out there we don't see in the corporate environments we work in or in all the usual environments that most of us that are watching the show or listening to the show think about. It's really good stuff. A lot of insights, a lot of new learnings, and that's coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 735, recorded Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. Floss Without Borders. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/floss and book a demo today. Good morning, good evening, good whenever it is, wherever you are. I am Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. And at the moment, anyway, I am co-hostless. And so, but one may drop in. In the meantime, I'm just going to go straight into the show because we're a tiny bit of a late start. Our guest this week is Ahmed Sobha, which on his LinkedIn, that's on his LinkedIn, I think, but on his Twitter is Ahmed Zakaria. So let's just start there because we were starting to talk about it before the show. And you're in München in Deutschland. That's right too. So
that's true. That's true. Thank you very much for having me, for starters. The name thing, it's a bit different how it works in the Middle East. So you keep carrying the names of all the parents in your family. So if your name is, for example, Michael, and your dad's called Eric, so your name would be Michael, Eric, and then the last name. That's how it works. And then if you have a kid named Tom, so he's going to be Tom, Michael, Eric, and so on until the generations go on afterwards. So my actual name is much, much longer than this. So I picked Zakaria as one of my grandfather's names, basically, as the name that I go by. But when I moved to Germany, they said, we have to have the last name on your passport, which is the last grandparent.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then I had to change my identity, basically, as a person everywhere except Twitter, because I forgot to do that.
That's good. It's interesting. On the one hand, you have like a menu of choices because you have all these ancestors. And on the other, you have the bureaucracy in Germany that says, let's see, which one is closest to the end of the alphabet? We'll use
that's
that one.
Exactly it.
Yeah. It's, as mentioned before the show, that my mother was Swedish and half my ancestors, therefore, are Swedish. And in Sweden, like in some countries, your name, like if your name is Anders and your son is therefore Anderson. And apparently in Sweden, they cut that off. They said, we're going to freeze everything and everybody's last name to be whatever it was. And it turned out like a third of the country were Andersons. So, and they kind of got stuck with that. That may be off. Maybe some Swedish listeners or viewers can jump in and correct me on that. But it's names are wild. So, so tell me a little bit. You're an open source guy. Your job is around open source. But you're with I have so many tabs open. Ivan. So tell us about Ivan and connect those dots for us.
Yes. Well, I work in open source, which is something I'm extremely grateful for because. I mean, it's not every day that you get to work in something that you're actually passionate about and believe in. My open source journey isn't that extensive or long. I started in 2020. I worked at Mozilla, the Firefox company. From there, I gained a different perspective on software because before that, I was working back in my home country in Egypt, and open source isn't really a big thing back in Egypt. It's mostly proprietary software with trying to commercialize as much products as possible. So open source or working in open source wasn't really something that I interacted with a lot. I've heard of it. I kind of understood what it's about, but not really that much into it. But after I worked at Mozilla, I kind of gained a different perspective on things, understanding what open source is, because working on Firefox is an open source project. It is owned by the company, but still you welcome contributions from anyone in the community, and the community around Firefox is huge and amazing, actually full of great people and great contributors. After that, after Mozilla, I worked at SAP, worked with Rust, also an open source language, which I basically picked up at Mozilla, and got a bit deeper into open source and understanding what open source is. So when I moved to Ivan afterwards and got the chance to be working in an open source program office, that was just an amazing opportunity because Ivan offers managed services for the open source databases. And the open source program office, the main and the only duty of the open source program office is contributing upstream to the projects that we offer managed services for. So the company offers managed services for example, Postgres, Kafka, Flink, OpenSearch, all of these open source projects. We, in our open source program office, we hire people just to work on contributions and upstream contributions to these projects, which is in its own thing amazing because you just get hired, get paid to work on open source project. For me as an engineering manager, it's much more challenging than other engineering manager jobs or engineering manager positions because you are working with a team that's working on a project that is not owned by the company or owned by the team. But it's a good challenge in itself because you interact with the community, understand how the community works. Each project has its own way of working, has its own kind of community. You interact and work with very different, diverse types of people, different cultures, different backgrounds. So it's amazing all around. And our open source program office is very special in that way, in that people are just focusing on helping, maintaining these projects and sustaining them, making sure they're well maintained, making sure that they have contributions going all along. We have several maintainers depends on the project. Sometimes they call them maintainers, committers, depends on how they're calling each project. But we have several of those people on our team, which is a great thing to see that we hire people. I mean, sometimes we hire maintainers, but at other times we hire people and work with them and build their own open source career and open source path and open source journey towards being committers on these projects, which is always very nice to see. And it's amazing thing for the community itself.
It's. I'm curious. Did Ivan itself grow out of a particular open source community? And you work at cloud databases. Like, did it come out of Postgres or one of the other database communities and say, "Hey, let's start a company that's all about this."
Yeah, our founders are long-term contributors to Postgres, so you can say that it grew from here. This is where everything started, and the whole roots of the company are open source, given from that start or how the company started. So. From that point on, it was all about, of course, maintaining the product and maintaining the growth of the company with trying to, contribute to open source as much as possible. So, yeah.
That's great. So just tell us a little bit about what Ivan does. Ivan?
Both work.
Yeah. When you're working in multiple languages, you cut a lot of slack to people. Close enough.
Yeah, true.
So... It makes setting up cloud databases simple. And you list a whole lot of companies, Comcast, Toyota, UK government, Atlassian. These are big customers. And so I'm wondering, so what is it, why would I want Ivan rather than some other thing? Just to give a little plug to the company.
Yeah. Well, if you want to set up, for example, let's take one example, set up your own Kafka cluster. And you'll want to deal with all the hassle of doing that and maintaining that, making sure that it works in the right way. Just go to Ivan, choose Kafka as a product, talk with one of our representatives for a few minutes or without even talking. You can just deploy your own service on your own platform in 10 minutes. And then everything will be set up. We also have your bring your own cloud initiative where you don't even need to migrate from your current cloud provider. You can stay with all the existing setup and we just do everything for you. So I think to answer the question, why would I choose Ivan? Because of the ease and the absolute simplicity of just starting up things without caring about all the hassle that you have to go through. I think also with Ivan, I mean, it depends on how much you care about open source. But with Ivan, you just know that working with Ivan or having something with Ivan, you're giving back to the community and you're also giving back to these open source projects, even if it's behind the scenes, but you're still part of it.
That's great. And I'm projecting on, I'm reading the literature here and I'm thinking, I'm just wondering, would individuals be possible customers for
Absolutely. For Ivan? Yeah. Doesn't have to be a company. Developers are, our most important customers, if I can say this. So it doesn't have to be a company at all, just individual people working.
So I'm wondering if like I look at Comcast, Toyota, Atlassian, are there, when those companies use Ivan, are they also like looking for individuals working for them that would want to do their own clouds as well? I'm just wondering how the whole thing grows by budding, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it starts differently with different companies, but as you exactly mentioned, in some cases, it's just one person who finds the idea appealing and finds the ease of the setup and the ease of the usage with Ivan very appealing. And then things escalate from there. This person recommends it to his team or their team, and then think goes forward from there. Entire team is using Ivan. Next, they talk to other people in other teams. And then we have someone from the company contacting us saying, our people really like this product. Let's have a deal struck. So it's not always a corporate deal between two C-suite people talking to each other. It just sometimes starts from a developer who just likes a product, and then things go from there. So yeah, we also have free tier options on our project. Mm. So even some people can just try the product and see how much they like it, how easy it is, and then they can go from there. So yeah, it's all about the developers.
So it's interesting to sort of contrast the way that works for you with Ivan versus the sort of what you're up against in, I'm thinking of your presentation that I enjoyed talking about governments that, you know, governments are the biggest customers in developing countries where they're often, you know, they buy expensive services from big companies. They're almost always proprietary and generally they're you know, there's one hand, you know, washing the other, and they get locked in that way. And this is almost the opposite of that culture. And I'm wondering, is what you're doing with Ivan and generally in your work kind of subversive that way, where you're dealing with developing countries, showing them a completely different way to work that ends up being more productive?
Yeah, I mean, open source and proprietary software in developing countries is a very difficult topic to tackle. Because I grew up in a developing country and was raised and learned everything I know basically about software there, it's a very different mindset. And the trust in a product that says it manages an open source service, an open source project, the fact that it relies on an open source project under the hood, basically, that kind of makes the project or the product of the project lose some of its trustworthiness. Unfortunately, that's something that's set in the culture, set in the mindset that open source projects are not safe to use. They're not very secure. Depends on the scale, of course, and depends on the type of people we're talking about or type of product they're working on. But unfortunately, that, as you mentioned, government institutes, they don't really trust open source projects because there's the mindset of this is not maintained by someone who's paid to do this, then I can't really trust it. I can't really trust something that people fix or update or evolve even more in their free time. And that causes a really big problem in these regions because people get stuck with a specific type of software that is usually forced upon them, and any attempt to change or move the stable waters so usually gets blocked, I would say. Because we don't need the hassle of working in an open source project because we don't really know what might happen tomorrow. What if they change the license? What would we do then? Ideas that go from there or go in this direction that we can't really trust the project. So it's a very delicate and difficult topic. And I don't foresee it changing in developing countries easily. I think, as you mentioned, how these governments get into deals with big tech companies from the US and from Europe, it's very difficult to break this cycle because I think I mentioned this also in my presentation. If someone gets elected or appointed in the right position, and this person, they have the knowledge and the understanding that, let's go open source because open source would save us money, first of all, as a developing country, and money is the most important resource for a country in that position. We would be able to self-learn about this. It's not something that's provided as a black box and we just use and that's it. We would understand how the product works and we'd part of the whole journey of the product. there are so many benefits that would benefit a country in that position, but that usually gets shut down because of the reasons I mentioned. And as you also mentioned, there's the ugly face of, yeah, we get paid to keep things as they are because there are other people benefiting from this. So things, yeah, the status quo doesn't really change. So it's going to be, yeah, it's a difficult challenge to change the situation. But I'm hoping that as time progresses and as I can see open source growing everywhere in the developing world, especially Africa, there was open source, I think what was called Open Source Africa. There was this open source summit in Nigeria last year that had 800 plus attendees, which is amazing to see. It's not something that you see, it used to see before. So I think, or I believe that in a few years, we might see things starting to change, at least not changing completely, but starting to change.
And that's really interesting because it's a little bit different than I would have expected. I would have expected that open source just would be everywhere because it's because of the free nature of it, right? And yeah, that everybody would be using it as much as possible. So that's really kind of eye-opening for me. How do you define a developing country? Is it different than what the standard definition might be? Is it different when we're talking about open source?
Yeah, I touched on this also in my presentation, that the term developing country, since it was first coined, it has changed a lot and went through different phases, and the world has changed a lot since this actually happened, since this term was first coined. I think it's 1960 by Walt Whitman. It's used to divide the world into two types of countries. There's developing countries and there's countries that are already developed. And the countries that are developed, they satisfy specific financial or economic threshold. And if they pass that threshold in terms of GDP and other GDP and other stuff, they are considered developed. And other countries are on their way of being developing and they're working towards being a developed country. Now it's changed a lot, I would say. There are three different categories that we divide developing countries. There are countries that are actually developing. So countries that are on their way to being a fully developed country, they're working towards it. They have the projects in place. They have the privilege of a free government that would help them get there. And let's say in 5, 10, 15 years, there would be actually an actual developed country. There are countries that are trying to develop, countries that are missing some parts of the ingredient, countries that are maybe don't have a free government, don't have enough financial power, but they're still trying. There's still attempts every now and then to become an actually developed country. And then at the end, there is this type of countries that are stagnant. And I also touched on this in my presentation, that the Arabic language is very accurate in describing these countries. It's called الدول المتخلفة, which means countries that have been left behind. And this is exactly what happened with these countries. The world has, in terms of not just technology, culture and everything else, the world has advanced and developed new ideas and new ways of living and working and using software. And these countries have been left behind. And the digital gap between the rest of the world and these countries is huge. And with this division, you better understand why the situation is what it is now. Because if you look at, on the example you mentioned, that if software is free, then it makes sense that it would be used in countries that don't have enough money. But that's not the only angle people look at. If I have a small business in a developing country, if I have a supermarket and I have a database system that I paid 50-100 euros for in the currency of the country, it's not cheap, but it's not expensive, and it works for me. And then someone comes along and says, hey, I have an open source project that you can use, and it would completely replace what you're using, and you wouldn't pay anything for it. 90%, 9 out of 10 times, the person would say, no, sorry, I have something that works for me, because they, one, do not trust the competence of people in their own country, in their own society when it comes to tech. So they know that maybe the person who developed this didn't do the best job possible, didn't really do it up to the standards of the product they're currently using. That's one thing. And number two, they lack the trust in the institutions that would carry on the job of doing what they should do if something goes wrong. So if I take this software and it doesn't work, or if it's messed up or something, there should be someone I should go to the company or where the person came from. I'd say, sorry, this doesn't work. Please help me out. Please carry out the appropriate legal actions. They don't really trust the system that would fix their problems for them. So that comes with a cost in itself, that yes, I will pay money for a piece of software that I don't know how it all works, or I don't really care how it works. Basically, I just pay money and it does its job. But in exchange for that, I get the ease of mind. I know who I'm going to talk to if it doesn't work. I know who to go to get the next version, and that's it. I don't have to do much work on my own. So yeah, it's surprising that open source is not much more common in these countries, but unfortunately it's not.
And so this is really kind of filling that gap, it sounds like, in a lot of ways that you just mentioned, right? Because you're able to help them deploy. Because there's also, and I'm just guessing, I know that people in these countries are really smart, so don't take my comments wrong, right? But even in developed countries, in the US, in Europe, in Asia, there is a big knowledge gap. People are struggling to find people that are experts in these areas, in cloud native, right? And I'm just looking through your website now. A lot of this looks like, it really has to do with cloud native, Kubernetes, all the cloud providers, all of those things, right? And that's a really hard thing to learn unless you go to school for a long time and have actually a lot of work experience. So are you helping to solve for the knowledge gap as well?
Yeah, I mean, I personally try to participate as many initiatives as possible that would help with the knowledge gap. Not at Ivan. At Ivan, we have our own community meetups everywhere. Unfortunately, not much in the developing part of the world. That's something we look to as the next phase in the company's growth. Currently, we have all these meetups in all the developed parts of the world. And as you mentioned, that there's already also a knowledge gap in these areas, but we have lots of meetups for different projects and different topics where people get together. They have some presentations and it's free to attend. People just show up and listen to others talk about the topic they're interested in and learn a lot. But also, these kind of initiatives are quite difficult in the less developed areas of the world. I also touched on that in my presentation because there is, I can mention also in my presentation, the three pillars that are challenges to open source. There is a society and culture. There is the aspect of freedom. And there's the aspect of being able to change, being able to accept new ideas. The aspect of freedom is usually kind of a problem in these areas where it's not easy to set up a new community or start a new initiative or start a new meetup or start a new organization because of prosecution reasons, because of government bureaucracy, even if it's not prosecution, just government bureaucracy and jumping through hoops. You have to get many approvals to do these kind of things. So that's another challenge that people face in these areas that, of course, the age of COVID helped a lot with that because lots of this can be done virtual now. Just have a Zoom meeting where people can show up and attend and that works. But if you want to do something in person, then you have to go through lots of hoops and jump through lots of hoops and go through lots of bureaucracy steps to get any of this done, which makes it really difficult in these areas. And so that's something also that's going to take quite some time to change.
So we have a bunch of more questions that queued up, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Collide has some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture, device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log in to apps. But just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted. Maybe they're running on out-of-date OS versions, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. For example, a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Using end-user remediation helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overwhelming your IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or to stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet. Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. When a user logs in with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from logging in. It's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more or book a demo. That's KOLIDE.com/floss. Okay, so Ahmed, in your talk, you gave the case of somebody, an open source person, somebody working on open source, whose maybe job title has open source in it, who's still saying, he says, well, somebody stole my work and they're using it somewhere else. How is this okay? And I'm wondering how much of this is due to just an inadequate understanding of what open source is and how it works and how it promulgates through the world, and how much this is just human nature. We're all born with opposable thumbs. You know, if a three-year-old is holding something that they made, they're going to say, it's mine. You can't have it, right? Because you think there's only one of it, and having only one of it is a good thing. And I'm also remembering back in the 80s and even into the early 90s when I first heard about free software. I'm not a developer myself, so I didn't know much about it, but trying to get my head around the GPL, what Stallman was talking about, what free really meant, free isn't freedom rather than, you know, free isn't beer. It's kind of hard to get one's head around. So I'm wondering if in the developing world, how much of this is just human nature and how much of this is peculiar to those circumstances?
Yeah, that's quite interesting how you touched on the human nature part, because I completely agree with it. I think lots of the time, these kind of behaviors would be attributed to the upbringing and the environment and the culture where the person grew up and the person knew about software. But there is also a human nature side to it, because it's not just people from developing countries who make that inaccurate association. So the example I provided is someone who was born and raised in my own country, and they work at one of the biggest tech companies in the world, working one of the biggest open source projects in the world. I think they were not very aware that it's considered open source. It can be called open source because there are lots that can be said about that particular project from both sides, but it is open source. The core of it is basically open source. And along came this other company that created another project based on that open source project. And now it's changing the face of the internet, or how we interact with the internet every day. And their opinion was that their own work was stolen. And as you say, I would attribute this to both at the same time, human nature, but not, I mean, the human nature side of it would not be enough for the person to claim, oh, I was stolen, or my work was stolen from me. Because I think the extent of how we, I mean, that gets you to label something as being stolen is 100% attributed to how you first interacted with software. And that's what happened to me personally. I grew up with knowing that software has to be either bought or cracked, unfortunately. That's how lots of kids in the early 2000s, in my own age bracket and in my own country, would get access to software that they cannot afford. You want a game that is quite expensive. You can ask your parents to buy you a game that expensive for a PC game. You just go online, find somewhere to crack it. And that's unfortunately wasn't, I think even in the developed part of the world, wasn't really prosecutable until like recently, like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Before that, it was totally fine. That's something that used to happen, and that's it. So this perception of software, when the person has a journey of 10, 12 years working as a software engineer with this mindset, and then they get faced with the idea, oh, you're working on a project that any person at any point in time can take and go start their own product. That's the reaction that you would expect at that point in time, that, yeah, my work was stolen. I worked on this for me and for my own company and for my own benefit. So I think the very basic, very first interactions with software in these regions, if open source is part of these interactions, is open source a part of these first learnings about software, that would change how people perceive software in these regions. Because they do, by the way, I did use a couple of open source projects in my university time, but it was for learning purposes, to improve my skills, to use the projects for my own benefit. I remember in my first job, the product we were working on was using an open source project. And the only angle I could see that it could benefit from using this project is if I find a bug, I can just fix it locally and move on with my life. I don't have to wait for the next release, or I don't have to call customer service or do any of these things that people do. I just fix it locally and then build the project again and use it. That was my perception at the time. The angle of giving back to the community or helping others or sharing this project amongst different companies or products, that didn't even cross my mind at the time. So as time progressed and I worked in open source and worked at a couple of companies that are actually concerned with open source, that changes with time. So it's not something that's set in stone. Yes, there is the human nature element. Yes, there is this selfishness that humans have. But I believe that learning about software in the context of open source as part of the image, I think that would affect how people would perceive open source in these countries once they get to interact with it. It wouldn't be as defensive or as hostile as someone stole my work. That's what I think.
So it's pretty funny that you just said that, because you kind of answered the question to a degree that came from the chat room, but I'm going to ask it anyway. It's super related to that. It's almost the same thing, but let me ask it anyway. This comes from Gumby. Gumby says, given that universities and individuals who are self-taught likely have self-selected to open source, he says 100% FLOSS, right? But open source or 100% FLOSS, how does that play into the challenges of adopting FLOSS at the bigger employers? And I mean, one of the things I'm going to guess from what you just said is that, you know, other folks have had the privilege, so to speak, of growing up having this in schools, in their experience, you know, as a good thing. In their lives as they develop educationally, where that might not be the case for developing countries. Is that accurate?
That is very true. I remember the labs that we had, for example, in university, Linux was not part of the conversation in these labs when I went to university. Maybe it has changed now, and I hope, and I think it might have changed a little bit in some of the labs at least. But Linux was not part of the conversation. Linux was something that you would install your own machine and try to be cool with. I reuse open source software. I'm a really cool person. But it wasn't something that people or professors or TAs at university actually spoke to you about or recommended or just put as part of the picture. I think it's all a human behavior of seeing something for the first time, being hit with a specific idea for the first time after you've already built the specific perception of the bigger picture. So I understood software as something that I make for a company that gets to sell. And then 10 years later, someone comes and says, there is this other version, by the way, where you just work with people randomly on the internet and no one pays you anything. That's not going to be something that the person absorbs easily. So yeah, I think integrating open source into very basic foundations of open source learnings, that changes all that a lot. And as I mentioned when I was talking about the previous point, the people in these countries, they know about open source projects, but as I just said, they use it for their own benefit. So people pick up open source projects or contribute to open source projects to improve their skills. So someone says, I want to learn some Java. They look for an open source Java project and they try to contribute to it until they reach a specific level or until they're prepared enough for an interview at an actual company. And they're like, yeah, that sounds good. Thank you very much. This is my last interaction with open source. See you later. That's how it happens. So there's also this perception that it's cool that there's a project that I can work on, but I don't really care about where it goes, what it does, who does it benefit, what kind of community it interacts with. I just care about what I can get out of this. And this is also very understandable if you look at the environment and the setup that these people or people from these regions work in or learn in, basically. People sometimes need to pick up 1, 2, 3 jobs. And it makes sense that once I get that second job, I'm going to drop open source contributions all together, because it doesn't make any sense if you're thinking about your family or the income for your family, a paid job in software, second paid job in software, and freelancing job in software makes a lot more sense than just contributing to open source projects. So all of this together paints the picture of, this is just another thing that we can use to advance as engineers, which is good in its own sense. It's building good engineers, but it's not really the essence of open source collaboration and people working together and working towards building a community of people working on the same project. It doesn't really happen when the perception is like this. Is it?
Yeah. You mentioned in your presentation something about inner source. As a separate topic, I guess, from open source. What do you mean by inner source?
So inner source is exactly what open source is, but inside a company. So always trying to have projects that are shared and worked collaboratively on between departments and between teams. In my opinion, and that's what I mentioned in the presentation, it's a very good stepping stone for companies in these regions when it comes to open source. Introducing the idea of, let's have a project that every single department can contribute to, every single team can contribute to. It's not a product that is owned by any of these teams, because as you know, the agile naming goes, there's a product owner for a team that owns the product or owns how this project works. Let's have projects that are not like that. Doesn't have a product owner, doesn't have a tech lead working on it, doesn't have a set of engineers with some QA people working towards some backlog of tasks. Let's have something that's a bit more open, exactly like any open source projects, but for the company, where you have some features that everyone would like to see. You have forums where people can interact on inside the company. These forums can just be GitLab issues or GitHub issues or something that people just discuss where they want to go with the project, where they want to take the project in. And it becomes a shared responsibility within the company that everyone in the company wants to see the advancement of this project and wants to see this project succeed. I think doing this builds this perception or builds this culture of collaboration within companies, within smaller organizations, even governmental organizations. If they do adopt this in their software institutions, this will build this collaboration mentality within each company. Also build expertise when it comes to open source. So if I do this for a couple of years and then I see or try to interact with an open source project, it's not going to be this shocking experience where I'm like, I'm so lost. What can I do? Where can I start? Where can I pick up an issue, or who can I talk to? Who owns this? Who is the leader here? You kind of prepare your mindset and prepare your culture to embracing open source projects, embracing the culture of open source projects. So when you move on to open source, it's not as a shocking experience as it would be first if you just moved from closed source to completely open source. So I think inner source would be one of the solutions that I would think would help as a stepping stone moving the companies and the organizations in these countries to the next step.
Yeah, it's interesting. It sounds almost like an extended hackathon or something like that, where you're just getting together as a group and saying, let's all try to get this thing done. And then having that concept get embedded inside the culture of the organization, or at least freeing them to understand what the value of this could be, can kind of push them along. I'm a little curious that the, let me back up a little bit. So the large companies that I work with on a daily basis, they see open source as almost a competitive advantage these days, right? So big, I mean, and it's not just tech companies either, right? These are big financial institutions, insurance companies, companies that you would think would be adverse to open source. That's all changed now, right? 15 years ago, it was the opposite, right? Nobody wanted to run open source. Now, all of a sudden, open source is an asset. And especially with cloud technologies, open source is seen as the first way to go, right? And the only time you veer away from that is if there's, for some reason, there's a security thing or something that you have to choose a proprietary solution because, the security director is telling you have to. Anyway, all that to say is that there is this culture of open source first that has developed in so many organizations in the developed world. And I'm a little bit surprised, tell me if I'm wrong, that the desire to be like, name your favorite company, that has a good reputation, wouldn't also influence that to say, look, well, those big companies that we admire, that we want to be like, they're focusing on open source as the way to get to where they want to be. We should also look at open source. Do you find any of that? We want to be like that other company and adopt open source. That was a long question. Sorry about that. I had to set it up a little bit, but
no worries. I mean, it does exist, but on a much smaller scale than it is in the developed world. So there are some companies that are trying to adopt open source projects and work with open source projects. But I think the biggest challenge or the biggest blocker that some other companies face is the competency level. So not having, not just competency, but also there is the amount of people that they have available to them on the market, so that are skilled enough to do these kind of things. So in bigger companies, they have the time and they have the resources and they have the funds to hire people that either already know, for example, let's say a company is trying to use Kafka or Flink, they can either hire people specifically who are Kafka or Flink experts, and then they can go from there, or they can hire people who they can afford to let them have enough time to learn about Flink, learn about Kafka, and then take their journey from there on and then be the Kafka or Flink experts in the company. This luxury or this freedom or this ability is not as prevalent in smaller companies as it is in bigger companies. And things in the developed world are a bit different, where bigger companies are much, much bigger than they actually are in the developing part of the world. So let's say company X that is in the US, it has 10,000 engineers working at it in the US. The same company, its site in a developing country would have like 400-500 people. So it's also a different level, a different scale. So even if the initiative is there, the ability and the resources, don't want to focus on funds or financial resources, but resources in general are much, much less in these areas, which makes it difficult. Even if you have the initiative, even if you have the idea to do this, you cannot afford to have someone come on and then begin to understand these kind of things. And if you want to hire someone who already knows how to work with open source and has open source experience, the pool becomes much, much smaller. And there are much fewer people that you can pick from. And these people would naturally pick the highest companies like Company X and Company Y, Company Z, who just hire the top talents in the country. So I would agree that the initiative might be there in some cases, but resources make it much easier to sustain that kind of interest, at least.
I'm wondering, I noticed, I mean, you've worked for, you know, in addition to Ivan, Mozilla, which is a very pure open source company, also a nonprofit, which is another special breed. But you also work for SAP, which is, a gigantic company. And I'm wondering whether, we've had people on from IBM, and I've known a lot of people say from IBM who told me, and also Microsoft, because we had people from there as well, who said there was enormous internal resistance at first. And then all of a sudden, we had to go into compliance with our own engineers, because that's what happened. It wasn't just a strategic decision was made that we're going to care about open source. It was like Microsoft had to do Bing. They could do Bing with Linux. Sorry, they weren't going to do it with whatever their own web server was at the time. And I'm wondering, having been at SAP, Are you seeing, and especially in the developing world, where these big companies do sell to the big governments, especially, some of that cultural change happening? Is there, or am I just projecting that, just assuming nature will take its course?
It does. Yeah, there is actually that change is already there. From my experience at SAP, it was there. My team actually had a 1 day per month to just work on open source projects. Completely drop the product and just work on open source project. And that was something surprising to me, to be honest, that you usually view these big, very big tech companies as companies that are completely focused on products that can be sold. But as you exactly mentioned, it's not always a strategic decision. We, as a team who works on a product, we kind of force the hands of the company to go in that direction. If I'm, for example, I was at SAP, I was building a solution that was using Rust. And if you're working with an open source project and you use other open source dependencies, you already occupy lots of your time working on open source. You, for these dependencies, lots of them, you might need to add small feature or fix a bug and then contribute it back upstream. You're already doing lots of open source work by nature, because even if you're just building a product for your company that gets sold and it's not open source, but you're doing a lot of open source work by nature. And that in its own self forces the direction eventually. If the person who's responsible for product management and product planning realizes that the people or the engineers in his team or their team is with time consuming a lot of time working in open source projects, it's a very natural and logical direction to just use this as an opportunity to drive towards open source, because it's happening anyway. So might as well, I don't want to be cynical and say get credit for it, but might as well get credit for it. Might as well contribute to open source officially and brand your team and brand your company as a company that contributes to open source. So it's exactly as you mentioned. The nature of the tech industry in general and tech projects are available to everyone now, with some of the strongest of them being open source, that kind of forces everyone's hands in going to that direction. And that would take me into the next point that I always like to mention. It's not just using these projects. It's very important for these companies to also care about the sustainability and the existence of these projects. Just using these projects shouldn't be enough. And just funding these projects with money is not just enough. And this is something that I'm quite proud of that we do at Ivan, that we donate our most critical resource, which is time. People's time, we donate it to open source. We let people actively work on open source for a job, something that they get paid for. And even if you're on the marketing team at Ivan, sorry for the company pitch, but even if you're on the marketing team at Ivan and you contribute to an open source project, we have a program where you can go and submit. You say, I worked on this open source project during my free time, and you get paid for it. So that's how you can drive people towards it, make people feel like they're appreciated and they're well, not compensated just money-wise, but compensated in general with appreciation, also money-wise, for their contributions to open source. And that's something that is still being built up in lots of companies, but it's definitely the right way to go.
Yeah, it really comes down to the culture of the company and embedding that in the culture. And I love that idea of, you know, somehow recognizing the fact that somebody, you know, contributed to an open source project from a corporate view as well, like the corporation's actually recognizing them. What kind of support have you gotten in this effort? Not you specifically, but how much support has the effort gotten from, you know, the Linux foundations? And there's the Linux Foundation, but you know what I'm saying, like the large corporations. So like, you know, open source initiative or the large organizations, you know, like I can imagine like a Red Hat, for example, right?
Yeah.
This is hugely important for them as a company. So have you gotten any support from those folks, or do you see support coming from those organizations or companies to try to help out in the developing countries?
Yeah, I personally have not had any collaborations in that area yet. All my efforts and all my attempts are with people directly in my own communities and in my own circles and groups. And that's what I always try to do. But it's always, I mean, open source already struggles enough in the developing world. And I think that takes all the attention towards the developing world, which is fair and unfair at the same time. I mean, at least it makes sense that closing a smaller gap would take your attention much more than closing a much bigger gap. Not much initiatives that I've seen in that direction or that I've interacted with people who drive in that direction yet. But yeah, I'm hoping in the future this would actually change.
I want to get to more questions, but first I have to let everybody know that Club Twit is a cool thing. Club Twit is another great way to support our network. As a member, you'll get access to ad-free versions of all the shows on Twit, as well as other great benefits. There's a bonus Twit Plus feed, which includes footage and discussions that didn't make the final show edit, as well as bonus shows who started, such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, Ask Me Anythings, and Fireside Chats with some of your favorite Twit guests and co-hosts. As Floss weekly listeners, you may be interested in, you should be interested, not just may, you should be interested in checking out another Club Twit exclusive show. It's the Untitled Linux Show, hosted by our own Jonathan Bennett. So sign up to join Club Twit for just $7 a month. Head over to twit.tv/clubtwit and join today. We thank you for your support. So, this goes back to something you were discussing earlier, but I just want to get a little bit more of a sense of it. How much are people learning open source from each other or in more formal ways? And I ask that because when I was at Linux Journal, which I was for 24 years, I would often talk to like kernel developers and ask them, you know, I'd ask a room full of these people, you know, where'd you learn with C or whatever else you're using? And none of them said school. You know, they all said ourselves or each other. But we have community too, and that, which is another topic, because that varies from code base to code base, situation to situation. So I'm wondering how much self-teaching is going on versus community teaching, and how does that feed into community, which It's a word we throw around a lot, but it means different things in different cultures.
That is true. I mean, I would say almost all of open source knowledge would be self-taught, would be self-learned in these regions. As I mentioned, all my experiences with open source was at my first job. Back before I moved out of my country, working with libraries that I realized, oh, I can just fix this and then move on with my life using the local version. So that was the only exposure I got to open source. But the thing is, if there was an existing community that was strong enough to help people learn about open source, have people understand open source, things would have been much different. There would be a very different ability to learn about open source. And there are lots of challenges that come with building communities in these regions when it comes to open source. The biggest, and also I touched on that in my presentation, the biggest issue would be first access. That's also, I mean, because these are the projects that I have daily interaction with. So Flink, Kafka, OpenSearch, all of these big projects, they wouldn't be working or wouldn't be compiling or building with a weak machine or below average machine. So you have to have first access to funds and have to have access to equipment, which is a problem in these regions. The average university student, the average one, does not have access to good equipment or stock equipment, does not have access to high-speed internet. I remember vividly from my time in university, there were people who would be working on a project and they would say, I'm really sorry, I can't contribute. I can only contribute on Wednesdays and Thursdays because that's when I go to this place that has good internet. So they're studying computer science, but they don't have stable internet. This has changed a lot now and improved a lot, I would say, but still exists. These cases are still part of society or how society behaves. So access to equipment and the internet, education and self-learning becomes very difficult in that setup. As I just mentioned, if you can't compile a project, how are you supposed to learn about it? It becomes very, very, very difficult. There's also the issue of localization, where I understand that English is the language of the internet and the language of the world, let's say, that to be frank, it's a language of the entire planet. But there are lots of very good talents and very good software engineers in Africa, in parts of Asia and South America. They don't speak fluent English, and going to learn about a project and be self-taught about a project through documentation that's purely written in English, it's very difficult for them. It becomes very difficult for them to start, and they wouldn't have an entry point into the projects. That's how I try to say that. Usually the entry point is I open a page and it tells me, one, what does the project do? What language it's written in? How can I contribute? Where to go to contribute? Here are a list of first starters issues or beginners issues. If I can't grasp all of that in a language that I can understand, then it becomes very difficult to go into the project, and I would first need to improve my language and then come back, and it just discourages people from contributing at all. And in all of this setup, with the lack of equipment access, internet access, very easy to educate and self-learn, basically, very privileged few become the ones who are able to do this or self-learn about open source and contribute to open source. People like me who had the privilege of a working, compiling, able machine that can compile open source projects, people who had stable internet at their homes, becomes a few privileged people who can contribute to open source projects. And how can you build a community in these circumstances? It's just going to be privileged people who can contribute to the project only in their free time, and if you don't have free time, you can't really attract or maintain other volunteers, basically, because their lives or their situations or their access is different from yours, and then the project will either die at some point in time or just be archived as lots of open source projects are archived on the internet. So the issue of access makes it very difficult, even if you have the intention, even if you have the understanding, even if you have the need to learn about an open source project. Lots of these access issues would just discourage potential contributors or potential people who can contribute to open source projects. And that in itself it's more of a foundational issue. It's not something that you can change in the culture or in people's mindsets or how they think. It's different in each country. And each country, they have their own journey towards improving access for their citizens. But yeah, it's quite important to make this a bit easier for people to be able to read open source at the end.
So we've got a couple of related questions. I want to get to the one from the chat first, because we always try to do that. So Gumby asks in the chat, and it's a little bit of a longer story, but I'm going to summarize it here, hopefully. So he was saying in the 90s, he was in Sri Lanka working with, you know, there was a lot of open source folks and hobbyists and people, but they were all sprinkled throughout the country and they didn't know each other. They didn't have a way to connect with each other, right? So even if they wanted to, or even if they had access to technology, you know, back then, and of course technology's changed, but they just didn't have that connection. So he asks, what would promote the ability of these folks to find and support each other?
I think with social media being part of the world and how the world functions right now, that's something that would help a lot in these cases. Back in my times, forums were the only way of communication. People go on forums and ask each other's questions. It was simpler times. It was easier times. It was better times, in my opinion. But still, social media makes this a lot easier. You have people meeting together in a Facebook group and trying to collaborate on something, work on something. That's a much, much easier way than trying to meet up, which is quite difficult in these regions as for different means of access when it comes to organizing actual meetups and booking places and all these things that require resources. So I think initiatives that are on social media have been very effective recently, especially in Egypt, for example, in my country. Lots of open source initiatives have picked up a lot on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or any kind of Mastodon or any kind of social media outlet. So I think if I want to be precise of a specific solution, specific way, social media would be a very good direction to go when it comes to trying to help this with this.
Are there successes that you're seeing? So are there countries or continents that are starting to contribute more either to GitHub or other places where you see that there is success?
Yeah, I think I'm quite concerned with Africa because it's my own continent. I see Nigeria and Kenya, for example, a huge uprising when it comes to open source contributions. There are huge improvement in numbers when it comes to open source contributions. I just mentioned the open source summit or open source conference that was in Nigeria last year, 2022. 800 plus attendees is a number that you don't see in lots of developed regions of the world when it comes to open source conferences, to be honest. It's a quite significant number, but the one chart that you can see on the screen is the one that's a bit unfortunate, that all the African contributions amount to less than 2.5% of the world contributions to open source. That's what needs more work, that's what needs more improvement, given the fact that, by the way, most of the big tech companies, they outsource their work to exactly these regions because they, of course, for lower pay and lower wages, but they know about the existence of talents in these regions. So we already know that there are very good engineers, very good capable software engineers in these regions. So just giving them the means to contribute to open source, which would help a lot. As you can see in this list of top 10 countries that countries or more advanced countries outsource software development to, only three of them would be considered almost fully developed or actually fully developed. The rest are all just countries that are trying to develop, whether it's Egypt, Brazil, Taiwan, Romania, Ukraine, the Philippines, India, all of them countries that are trying to develop. But still, there is this recognition that there are very capable engineers, very capable software engineers in these regions. And I think that's a very strong foundation, I would say, very strong foundation to build on and have open source contributors in these regions. And it's been improving, as I just mentioned, because it's something that really made me feel like it's going in the right direction. The Nigerian conference is something that's worth admiring.
So we're down to the last couple of minutes of the show. And I just like to end with a quick question about what can only come from developing countries. You know, there's a, and I'm just wondering is there an answer to that? Of course, we're imagining things that may not exist right now, but I'm thinking as a class, if you could say briefly what you think can only come from the developing world.
Completely new ways to look at projects and solutions and things. That's something that I think has been dominated by specific point of view in most projects. You have people who are from the same regions, or as I say, the developed world, the US, Europe, and some parts of Asia. These are the people who have been consistently contributing to open source over the past 20, 30 years. But there's a completely new way of looking at things that people living in developing countries can provide. We have different perspective coming, different perspectives coming from different backgrounds, growing up in different conditions and situations. We would offer new solutions to long-lasting problems that have been there in the open source community for a long time. And I think that's the direction where most parts of the world are going at the moment. So trying to open up for different perspectives and different points of view from different people coming from different backgrounds. So it only makes sense that open source would also open its arms to people coming from developing countries. Because as I just said, the amount of talent that I've seen in my own country, just to be completely accurate and talk about something that I've seen with my own eyes, people have very clever ways of approaching solutions. I'm not saying that other ways are not clever, but they're clever ways giving their conditions, working around the hassles that they have to reach the level of knowledge that they have is something that is very impressive and could only benefit open source projects and open source communities, having these people as additions to the already existing very, very knowledgeable communities. Adding people to them from that status would be very good.
Yeah, I've noticed that generally the harder life is for people, the more resourceful it is that they are. People can be extraordinarily resourceful. When you're privileged, a lot is already taken care of for you, and you know how things are going. The car's going to run, you know, the roads will be paved, you know, things like that. But I've always been impressed by that. So we're out of time. So we always end with two questions. One is, what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Can you say that again? Sorry.
Oh yeah. We ask this of all our guests that, your favorite text editor and scripting language.
Scripting language. I would say Python is my favorite scripting language. Yeah. And I used to be a Vim person, but I grew to like C Lion very recently.
Mm.
Not, that's cool. I mean, yeah, not very proud of that as an open source person, but yeah.
Well, that's great. Ed has his sound effects. Well, thank you so much, Amit. This has been a great show, very informative and fun as well. And we'll have to have you back and talk about everything that's changed, you know, in a year or 2 years or whatever it's going to be, because I'm sure they'll have a lot to talk about again. So thanks for coming on. It's been great.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
I'll have you play music next time, too.
I will prepare something.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much.
So Aaron, that was a great show.
Yeah, I think so too. Very eye-opening. It's something that we all need to be conscious of. We live in our little bubble still. You would think that in this day and age, you know, we would know more about that, or I would know more about this stuff. I'm really talking about myself here. So it really is eye-opening to hear some of the challenges in other parts of the world that could inhibit open source, but also some of the encouraging trends that are happening as well, and some of the things that that we all need to keep in mind as we're looking to grow the open source community. So I found it super, super interesting to listen to and hear what's going on. So yeah, glad we had this show for sure.
Yeah, same here. I'm remembering back in the early days of Linux Journal. I mean, it was such an uphill thing. And probably we're going through the same thing back then as we are now in other parts of the world, where it seems like, oh my gosh, so many things are stacked against us. You know, especially where the large companies or the governments or whatever are buying old stuff, you know, buying old stuff that somebody greases somebody's palm to buy, and then, you know, it turns out, you know, a bunch of geeks are doing a better job and you have to use their stuff. And it's just, I'm just really encouraged by it. So,
yeah. Yep. Same.
So, can you give us your plugs? Cause you're working on some new stuff.
I'm working on some new stuff. Yeah. It's exhausting. there's always too much to do, but yeah. So obviously the YouTube channel is doing great and growing. In fact, I've got a video coming out.
It's Retro Hack Shack, right?
Yeah. Retro Hack Shack on YouTube. I've got a video coming out at 11. So right after this, you can tune in. No, don't turn away. Don't keep watching Twitch. Just kidding. No, but you can watch it anytime, of course, on YouTube. And it's actually where I do this new kind of a long running type of show called E-Waste Wednesday, because Wednesday is literally the day that I go to E-Waste and see what I can pick up. And so what I started doing was bringing this stuff back and talking about what it is, seeing if it works. You know, sometimes I do some quick repairs. Sometimes I get sucked in and do a long repair. But yeah, so I've got another video on that coming up at 11 a.m. this morning. I'm going to be looking at a Packard Bell monitor from the early 90s, an Atari 2600 that popped up.
Oh, I had one of those. There it is. Wow.
Yep. And then I'm also going to be looking at a Wise terminal from the early 90s as well. I think 1993. So anybody that worked on terminals will probably get nostalgic over this one. It's a great terminal. And I was able to hook up a Raspberry Pi to it and access the internet with the Lynx browser, text-based browser.
Oh, wow. The original browser, Lynx. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a super fun thing to put together. So I think people will enjoy it.
I'd like to on the video of seeing your joystick. That was the Atari 2600 joystick where you had to hold the base down. It wasn't heavy. Yes. You had to hold that thing down and press the red button while you're, and it was, oh man.
Yeah. And it didn't move that much. You know, that was the thing, right?
Yeah. It was pretty tight.
It was very tight and, you know, very crude actually, but it worked and it was cheap. And that's what it was all about back in the day, is making things for, you know, to get those margins up. And
they were very successful with that. Killed a lot of invading space things with those things.
Me too.
Wore out the red button. Well, this is great. And next week, a little plug toward next week, we're going to have David Siffrey on. Dave Siffrey created a company called Linux Care back in like the 90s. The whole idea was to get a bunch of geeks together to fix things. Did a bunch of other things after that. He's been an old friend. We ended up talking for 2.5 hours, but I just called him out of the blue and said, you got to come on the show. We can't like talk about this stuff and not have you on the show. So he's coming in next week. So that's what's coming up then. It's great having Ahmed on again, and we will see you next week.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. Then you already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow is a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.